Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
A new coalition to push Medicare for all. The Senate and the PRO Act. What happened yesterday? Uber and Lyft drivers strike for one day. And today on the show, it's working class perspectives and the United Steelworkers. Welcome to the Friday, July 23rd edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on five platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. We have two guests on the show today. John Russo will be back. Haven't had him on the show for a while. He is the visiting scholar of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, which is out of Georgetown University in Washington. And for many years, he was the labor studies guy at Youngstown State University. And we're going to talk about post-pandemic employment issues. Employees, and they're saying this quite a lot, they want a work-life balance. They like working remotely. They want some flexibility. We're going to get into that. As you know, there's a lot of people that were frontline workers in the hospitality industry, especially, that have said, I'm not going back. And I know a lot of restaurants are crying the blues right now, but that being said, they're looking for other opportunities. And they're also looking for jobs that will support their families. I'm going to read something. This is from Jack Metzger. And Jack is one of the contributing writers to the blog, workingclassstudies.wordpress.com, Biden and Social Wages. And he writes, if Biden's American family plan becomes law, as he has proposed it, his grandniece, Harry, will finally have a modest yet adequate standard of living based on a new commitment from the federal government to provide social wages. Now, let me explain. Harry is a 30-year-old single mother of two, one three-year-old, one in school. As an assistant manager at Walmart, she makes about $47,000 a year. But about $8,000 of that goes for daycare for her preschooler. She recently started getting $550 a month in a child tax credit, but that's just temporary. It's only for 1 year. Now, if the family plan becomes law, she'll get that money for another 5 years, and her preschooler will get free pre-K public education, freeing Harry from paying for daycare. Now, when you add it all up, Harry's income will be topped by $6,600, and she'll be saving $8,000 a year on daycare costs. So here's the deal. She'll go from having $47,000 a year in reported income to having $53,600. But with the absence of daycare costs, her real spending income will be enhanced by $14,600. You got to consider taxes and all that. That comes out to a 37% increase. And where she lives, which is in central Pennsylvania, the Economic Policy Institute figures that with no child care costs, she would need about $49,000 to have a modest yet adequate standard of living. $53,600 will not provide her with a life of luxury, but it's better than where she is now. Do you realize how many people are just like Harry in this country today? Oh, my God. That's when the tax credit went into effect last week. They said and said again and again and again, half the children in America would be lifted out of poverty. Richest country on earth. And we have so many people living in poverty, families living in poverty. And Biden is trying to fix all of that. So John's going to get into that. He's also going to talk about non-compete clauses. And I'm very familiar with those, especially they were very prevalent in the broadcast industry for years. You work at one station, things don't go right. And then in the contract, it says you can't work anywhere else for 6 months, maybe a year. Fred Redman will be joining us on behalf of the Steelworkers, one of our sponsors here on the show. Fred's a great guy. Been with the Steelworkers for 48 years. Started in 1973 at Reynolds Metals, local 3911. He is now the International Vice President for Human Affairs, and in that position, he oversees the union's Civil and Human Rights Department, and he has worked with steelworker allies all across the country to respond to right-wing attacks on voting rights and to combat economic inequality. And that's primarily what we're going to talk about on the show today, voting rights. Anyone who follows American politics knows what's going on. Republicans have virtually gone to war against mail voting, against early voting, and anything other than showing up at the polls on Election Day. I mean, 15% of the country, and this is as a result of Republican legislatures, have turned the screws on voting. And Fred is going to talk about the For the People Act, which would change all of that. Lots of good stuff on the Steelworkers website I want to call attention to. Their big campaign right now is investing in America again. I want to drive you to a video, and I don't know if I'll be able to play all of it. You just go to usw.org. McWayne Ductile. They make pipe in the state of Ohio, and they supply our nation's clean water systems. And the whole idea here is to call attention to our infrastructure, and the steelworkers are a big part of that. Let's listen to this clip that's posted on usw.org.
An investment in infrastructure in America is critical. And certainly people can see roads and bridges and understand when those have issues. But our water system was built at the turn of last century.
Everything gets older. We all know this, and nothing lasts forever.
If we don't get something started now, I think it's going to be too late. I don't think we'll ever get caught back up with it.
We have these water systems, these roads and bridges under the ground that people don't understand that are falling and crumbling apart. We take water for granted. It's something we think we turn on the tap and it just is there every day. But that water quality is in jeopardy. And you see a lot of other countries that are passing us by. In McWayne Ductile, Ohio, here in Coshocton, we have 500 employees. We make ductile iron pipe, which is basically for water and wastewater systems. We make ductile iron power poles, which are for our electrical infrastructure. We also make flange pipe, which is for water treatment plants, which will begin for clean water and wastewater applications. This is the hardest working workforce that I've ever worked with.
We've got some of the best people are here. We got some of the best products. Everything we do is we take pride in what we make and send out the gate.
Just because people here take pride in what they do, and we come here day in and day out for our families, that's just what we do.
My husband works here also, so we both work here, so we are a union family. Yeah, definitely good job.
And the one mantra that I like for our group is we're iron strong.
Well, if we rebuild this country like we want, like I would like to see it happen, I'd say we need to rebuild this country with American-made, union-made products.
I think union-made says a lot. American-made says a lot. It's just kind of one of those foundations that America was built on.
It costs money to replace and put it in the ground, so you might as well go for it and put the best in the ground. It's going to last a lot longer. You don't have to replace it going down the road. That was pipe would be in there for 100 years or better.
It's pretty much guaranteed that our stuff will be there for our kids, our grandkids.
It's not only an investment in our future, it's an investment in our children, in our children's children, and most likely our children's children's children. So I think any time that you're trying to grow the economy and grow the future and invest in our people, you're going to have to spend. So I do see it as an investment in our future. And again, it's providing jobs, it's good paying jobs that allow people to raise their families, to have health insurance. I'm very proud of this facility because you can live the American dream.
I wasn't going to play that whole clip, but my God, it's so good. I just got into it. Union made, American made. That's what it's all about. I just wish their politicians, especially the conservatives, would finally realize we have to do something about our infrastructure. Listen to the workers, especially the steel workers. That's posted on the steelworkers website, usw.org. They also have another website you can go to, usw voices.org, usw voices.org. So Fred Redmond, he'll be our second guest right here on the show. Well, yesterday, the U.S. Senate, we touched on this with Bill Samuel, they voted 51-50 to confirm Jennifer Abruzzo as general counsel for the National Labor Relations Board, with Vice President Kamala Harris casting the deciding vote. Her confirmation by an equally divided party line vote to end Senate debate on the nominee marks an end to a very bitter partisan Senate debate over her appointment. Yeah, the conservatives said, oh, she's too much union. We can't have her on the NLRB. In the meantime, the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions voted to advance two more Biden nominees to the NLRB. That's Gwen Wilcox. She's a partner in a union side law firm, and David Prouty, general counsel for the Service Employees International Union. And if confirmed, Wilcox and Prouty would put an end to the board's current Republican majority. And that needs to be done. Meanwhile, that same committee held a hearing to discuss the PRO Act, Protect the Right to Organize Act, H.R. 842, legislation that would overhaul federal labor law and better enable union organizing. That bill, which passed the House earlier this year, remains stalled in the Senate. And Senate budget negotiators announced plans last week to include key provisions of that legislation in the Democrats' upcoming reconciliation package, such as the bill's civil penalties provisions. And they are enormous, like $50,000 to $100,000 if you break labor law. Chair Drivers United staged a nationwide strike. This was on Wednesday, and this was in anticipation of what happened in Washington. So the Uber and Lyft drivers staged rallies in a number of cities: Los Angeles, San Francisco, Boston, Las Vegas, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, Austin, Texas, and the heart of this show, where we record it every day, Cleveland, Ohio. In New York, the New York Taxi Workers Alliance held an online seminar on the PRO Act in solidarity with the rideshare drivers. Good stuff there. In the meantime, a new coalition has come together to celebrate Medicare's 56th birthday, which is tomorrow. That's right. Tomorrow, Saturday, July 24th, is the 56th birthday of the passage of Medicare. And what's happening is that a coalition of groups is all coming together to march for Medicare for All. So take what we have with Medicare and expand it to everybody in the country. Young, old, rich, poor, doesn't matter who you are. Universal health care, pretty much. It's kind of interesting, too, because who is in that coalition depends on which city you're talking about. There's no one single group behind it. There's a number of groups, and some people are politically homeless. They're not identified with Democrats or Republicans. They just want better health care. That's it. That's it. And I'm reading from their website. You got to check this out. M4M4All.org. M4M4All.org. And it reads as follows. Our movement was founded from a place of compassion and love. We came together out of frustration with the lack of action from the powers that be. Many of us have our own personal stories as to why we're in this fight. All of us know that healthcare is a right, not a privilege. It's a basic freedom. How can we have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness when we live in constant fear of illness, bankruptcy, or homelessness, all because of the outrageous for-profit healthcare system? One illness can ruin your life, even if you have insurance. The industry can always say no. We need a big fat yes. Whatever you and your doctor decide is best for your health, that's what should be done. No more pre-authorizations, deductibles, out-of-pocket expenses, etc. These are all barriers to the care we deserve. Nearly 70,000 times a year or more, someone dies because of these barriers, and that is unacceptable. They're absolutely right. So tomorrow, a lot of groups coming together all across America, Saturday, July 24th. And if you want to get more, just go to m4m4all.org. All right, we're going to take a quick break when we come back. John Russo, on behalf of Working Class Perspectives.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with cancer after taking Zantac? If you have taken Zantac and have cancer, you may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency. Celebrating 50 years. Started in Cleveland, Ohio in 1971. You can find more at ulagency.org. Let's go to our live line right now. Welcome back. It's been a while. John Russo, visiting scholar at the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, started the Working Class Studies at Youngstown State University many, many moons ago. And the website you want to go to is workingclassstudies.wordpress.com. There's a great selection of articles on people talking about working class issues. I mentioned the Jack Metzger piece, and Jack is a I believe he's a professor at Roosevelt University. What's the status of Jack Metzger?
He's retired from Roosevelt University, where he was a professor of philosophy, but who wrote a lot on working class life and culture.
Okay, good, good, good. Well, that was a good preamble to the show today, because you want to talk about the changing environment of work in America and the need for families, especially families with children, to get help, especially from the federal government. And the child tax credit, which went into effect last week, has helped a whole lot of people and will help more if they continue it. That's another debate in Congress. But The employment situation in America today, let's address that, because there's a lot of people saying, hey, I need workers, I can't get workers, and then the workers are saying, I'm not going back to my old job. What's your take on what's happening in America, John?
Well, I think it's pretty complicated, first of all, but I've been getting a number of phone calls from journalists, and the most recent one was one reporter from a paper in Florida, wanted to understand why employment wasn't growing in Florida. And after going through some of the statistics, I said, what I want you to do is to go to the Publix grocery store. It's one that you see down in the South a lot. And look and see who's bagging the groceries. In the past, retirees that were trying to supplement their income would go down there and work.
Mm-hmm.
They're not there. They're not going back to that environment. They're nervous about the pandemic coming back and getting the virus. They don't feel like it's worth it to get that pittance of a wage that they were getting as a bagger in the grocery store. It really just wasn't worth it. And I think that was sort of a metaphor for other workers who are reluctant to go back to work for the types of wages and benefits that they're being offered. And I think that even though with employers and government officials are complaining about the labor shortage and the lower than expected job growth, they're really not paying much attention to what it means to be a worker in this particular environment. And so you add to that the large number of workers who've been laid off during the virus pandemic and who are not returning to their jobs. And just think of what's happening right now, Ed. Students usually work summer jobs, but they're going back to school, and there's no one there to replace them. Mm-hmm. And at the high-end range, where foreign workers are sometimes used under the H-2B visas, they've been capped. And then you add to that travel restriction and close the consulates, that's exacerbating the problem. So all of this means that it's not only that there's a labor shortage, but if we believe the recent labor statistics, the number of jobless claims last week were up 419,000 from the month before. So things are not going back to normal, and it's unlikely now with the new virus scares that are going on because of the Delta variant, that a lot of people are unwilling to go back. Again, let alone what Jack's piece had mentioned about the work-life balance, especially for women who have been taking care of their children and may not be going back to the work anytime soon. And there's the cut the other way. A lot of employers have used the pandemic to increase artificial intelligence and automation. And those jobs won't be coming back, period.
Mm-hmm.
So even though when you hear employers and government officials complaining about the so-called labor shortage, there's a lot that's going on in that includes both social and economic issues surrounding employment and employment in the future. And it does say something about what the future of work might look like, where you have fewer workers making more money in higher paid jobs, and then the lower paid jobs and working class jobs are going to continue to be low end. Because I don't see anybody, well, you see a couple companies trying to raise their wages if they're large enough, but that's not happening overall.
John, will that make income inequality even worse than it is today, if that continues to be?
Of course. I think that's just it's going to continue to grow. And for small businesses, I understand, and I've talked to a number of them here in Youngstown, because I'm back in Youngstown for the summer, and they're hurting. They don't have the demand because people don't have the money. They're just trying to skirt by, and many of them are going to be closing. And it's going to be interesting. Sherry and I were talking to people involved in the land banks here in Youngstown, and what happens when they end some of the programs that said you can't foreclose and kick people out of their houses that they're renting.
Yeah.
So it's just a general lack of demand in the economy because of the pandemic, and not paying enough in terms of wages in the past. That's an overhang in some ways from the past. And then with the onset of artificial intelligence and more automation, I think they all sort of contribute to a rather dismal looking future of work.
John, can you help me out on this artificial intelligence? I've heard that so many times. Can you explain that? Because I don't think I fully comprehend what artificial intelligence is.
Well, there's just look, you can think about it in your own business, the radio. You have a lot of basic music stations that are all coming out of one particular location, yet you have just one person who in those particular areas that are doing the promotions and things like that. How can that possibly be happening? Is because of artificial intelligence and different forms of communication that are built into that. You can hear it in terms of various types of robocalls, and these are the most obvious ones.
But
in manufacturing, we see a lot of jobs that were formerly low-skilled jobs that are being made routine because of artificial intelligence and automation that's connected with it. And so they don't need people. And that obviously is done to reduce labor costs. And it's often described by economists as progress, and that new types of jobs will be created. But and in the past, that some of that has really happened. But this time around, artificial intelligence and automation is so ubiquitous that it's affecting many industries at the same time. And so people displaced by one industry or one type of job can't go necessarily to another one because they're the same thing is happening.
Gotcha.
Think of, you know, what happens, think about what happens if you get these automated trucks. How many truck drivers' jobs will be eliminated?
Right.
You know, if you can keep going down the list and talking about various types of industries and how they're using automation, artificial intelligence. But there's going to be a problem ultimately, I think, in demand because of people aren't going to be making enough wages to purchase the products that are being produced by automation and artificial intelligence.
Scary future there. Jobs without people.
Yep.
John, I got to take a quick break. John Russo joining us on our live line. He's the visiting scholar at the Cal Monovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor out of Georgetown University. Later in the show, Fred Redmond will be joining us on behalf of the United Steelworkers. He's going to talk about the attacks on voting in America. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you were exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, we're available on 5 platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Pandora. Let's go back to our live line and rejoin John Russo. John started this segment we call Working Class Perspectives with us, my gosh, probably 12, 13, 14 years ago. And if you get an opportunity, just go to workingclassstudies.wordpress.com. There's a lot of good articles talking about working class issues. I mentioned the Jack Metzger article. There's many, many more and more to come. One of the issues I know you wanted to talk about, John, is these non-compete clauses. Biden made a reference to that, and he wants to bring more competition. Right now, you see this, especially these big companies, they consolidate, and the first thing that they do, they shed jobs when they consolidate because there's some duplication. But he wants to go back, sounds like, the old days And I'd like to get your take on that. Hopefully he'll get some cooperation from Congress. I don't know. I feel bad for the guy. I mean, he's trying to do everything possible. All these roadblocks are coming up, especially from Mitch McConnell. But talk to me about the non-compete clauses. Let's start there.
Well, the non-compete clauses are part of an arrangement of various types of activities that employers are engaging in right now. They want to keep employees, and one way to do them is when that they are hired, they say, if you get hired, you're going to have to sign a non-compete clause should you leave. And that is incentive for them to stay with a particular company. More egregious thing I'm seeing right now, and you'll love this, Ed, is that there are train repayment agreements that says if you get any training to get this particular job and you leave within a certain period of time, you have to pay us back all the money that we invested in you.
Oh, no.
That's a new one. I haven't seen that before, but there's a couple of lawsuits in, I think, Indiana and Illinois right now that are going on with that. We're seeing some employers changing their screening processes, and in fact, some states are no longer permitting pre-employment screening for marijuana to get qualified workers. So there's a whole range of activities. And then there's other things that have always bothered me, is that a lot of new employers coming to an area talk to the Chamber of Commerce about what the average wage in the area is. Well, there's a type of incentive for the Chamber of Commerce and other business groups to artificially keep wages down. And so that is still in existence. And so you get all these sort of other issues that don't usually get a lot of attention that are also impacting future employment. And I don't know if I was a worker in this particular environment and suddenly there was a demand for my labor, that I would want to sign a non-compete clause any more than I necessarily want to sign $100, signing agreement. I don't know if you've been seeing those, but here in Youngstown, we see a lot of various stores involved in commerce offering a $100 bonus to sign. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see the whole agreement. And I don't think $100 is going to make a big difference ultimately. The minimum wage has to go up, and it has to be more of a universal. It can't be just done on a statewide state basis, and it's got to be closer to $15 an hour. Now, that's going to cause some businesses to fail. There's no question about that. But at the same time, if a business can't afford to pay living wages, maybe it shouldn't be in business.
I hear you. There's a lot of them in that boat. How long do you think this situation is going to last? There's a tug of war going on right now with the managers, with employers, and they're saying, oh, well, we're raising the wages. We're giving better benefits, and they're still not coming. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, there's a lot that's going on in terms of that. I mean, there, like Jack had said in his original piece, there are some issues around work-life balance.
Right.
There's questions about people who like the types of flexibility that the pandemic brought. So this sort of remote work is something people like. We're seeing movements now to suburban areas, that is satellite campuses that are going on right now. So work is actually physically moving at the same time, either back to home or to suburban areas. That's also having an impact on employment issues. And the whole discussion about wages just gets me in a real bad mood. Let's just say that. Because if you take a look at the juxtaposition between all these recent tax evasion scandals with the conservative people's claim that jobless benefits are too generous, and it's indeed evidence of a national economic emergency, I just don't buy that hypocrisy. You know, mm-hmm. You can't have the types of inequality and tax evasions and then claim, geez, those unemployment benefits are just too generous. It's very disturbing and dishonest.
Well, there's so many people in America that like to demonize the poor. I mean, how many times have you heard somebody say, hey, you know what? This is the land of opportunity. If you can't make it, there's something wrong with you. I mean, how many times have you heard that, John?
Lots. And it's just the way of sort of making working people feel guilty. You know, that, you know, you don't want to go to work, you're lazy, you know.
Right.
You know, it's pretty pathetic.
I know. It's not good. And it's one that we definitely have to talk about and address here on America's Workforce. Well, it's good to hear from you. John Russo, visiting scholar at the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor out of Georgetown University. When will you be going back to Washington?
About a month. Okay. Sure, he's got to start back at Georgetown teaching, and I'll go back and just start meeting with students and helping them with their research at Kalmanovitz.
All right. Well, in the meantime, enjoy the summer in Youngstown, Ohio. All right. You take care.
My favorite vacation home.
There you go. Take care. Stay safe. And we'll be in touch. All right.
Very good.
All right. We're going to take a quick break when we come back. Fred Redmond on behalf of the United Steelworkers.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our Raising Wages agenda, go to AFLCIO.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
To America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook. That would be AWF Union Podcast. And follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. Before we join Fred Redmond of the Steelworkers, a little bit of labor history. It was this month, 62 years ago, year was 1959, a 500,000 steelworkers began what became a 116-day strike that closed down nearly every steel mill in the country. Imagine that. The management wanted to dump contract language, limiting its ability to change the number of workers assigned to a task or to introduce new work rules or machinery, which would have resulted in reduced hours or fewer employees. So the union said, that's not going to happen. And after 116 days, they got what they needed to get done. So hats off to the United Steelworkers, proud sponsor of America's Workforce. And joining us on our live line right now, dear friend, often contributor to the show America's Workforce, Fred Redmond, who handles human affairs. He's also a vice president. He's been with the Steelworkers since 1973, 48 years. Fred, that's a long time. How are you doing, brother?
Tell me about it. It's been too long. Still having fun, though, Flash. Still having fun.
Oh, I tell you, we love having you on the show. You bring so much good content. We appreciate that. And in your position, you oversee what's going on in America, especially with voting rights. And we can do hours on this subject because it needs to be addressed. It needs to be fixed. And what's happening in America right now is so wrong. And it's continuing to happen. Talk to me about the steelworkers' role and what we're going to do about this voter suppression drive ever since Trump said it was a rigged election.
Right.
It should have gone to Trump. I'll let you pick it up from there, Fred.
Well, the sad part about it, Flash, is we thought that he would be through preaching that sermon by now, but he seemed to be intensifying it more and more every day. The good news is people isn't buying it. But, look, first of all, I want to thank you, Flash, for your outreach and, you know, for keeping us on the map and keeping us in the minds of your audience. When I talk about we, I'm talking about America's unions. And I really appreciate you, if I could regress for 1 minute, I really appreciate you bringing up the 1959 steel strike. That was a defining moment, not just for our union, but for the labor movement and organized in the history of organized labor and collective bargaining. I mean, we really, really, I wasn't there then, believe it or not, but our union really stood that test of time. It was a test about the strength of a collective bargaining agreement and a company's rights to, what the company perceived as rights to expand their rights under management by being able to, as you said, you know, be able to reduce work crews, change the work within a steel mill, within a steel industry, to change the work processes without negotiating or just even discussing with the union. It was a challenge. I mean, but yep. 1959, people stood up. We won that fight. We were threatened by the government to be, you know, ordered. We were threatened to be ordered back to work by the government under the auspices of national defense. And, you know, steelworkers stood up during that period of time, and it made a difference in collective bargaining up to today. So thanks for mentioning that, Flash.
Not a problem.
Look, in terms of voting, the United Steelworkers, as every other union and in the AFL-CIO and throughout organized labor, we have supported the Voting Rights Act for decades, but especially since the Supreme Court stripped away critical protections for millions of voters throughout this country when it gutted key sections of the original Voting Rights Act in 2013. And that is why we support this John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which would update and reverse the Supreme Court's case and their atrocious ruling in 2013. The Supreme Court in that decision, Flash, in 2013, it led to dramatic increases in voting restrictions across the country. Since 2013, the Brennan Center has reported that 360 bills to restrict voting access has been proposed in 47 states. But so Texas, I mean, just think about this. Texas, less than 24 hours after that decision in 2013, announced that the state would put a strict voter ID law in the place. And since this terrible Supreme Court decision, voter roll purges have increased dramatically in locations that were subject to federal review when the Voting Rights Act was in place. And several states have passed sweeping voter suppression laws that disproportionately prevent minorities, the elderly, and the youth from voting. And between 2016 and 2018, more than 17 million voters was purged. And while some of this is natural, like therefore moving, but for many voters, if they are purged from voting rolls, they will not find out until they go to cast their ballot. So what we're doing with the John Bill Voting Rights Act, which is being proposed in the Senate as Senate 1 and in the House as H.R. 1, is under the For the People's Act. We will restore many of the provisions that were stripped in 2013, such as preclearance, where a state cannot arbitrarily change its voting rules without first seeking permission from the Justice Department. So we're in that fight. we're in that fight because democracy is at stake. And, you know, that's why we're supporting the John Lewis Voting Rights Act.
Now, with the complexion of Congress right now, we've got division. I mean, the Democrats, for the most part, they're pretty much on board with this. But you know what's going on the other side of the fence here. What needs to be done to convince some minds on this, Fred?
Well, I there's going to have to be a challenge. I mean, you know, we got, the Republicans, Flash, in the Senate is going to have to make a conscious decision, you know, whether or not they're going to vote, whether or not they're going to support the very foundation and the pillar of our democracy, the right for people to vote, or are they going to support a agenda by a president whose day is come and gone. So, you know, we need to do, from our end, we need to do more outreach. We really need to get people engaged in this fight, and we really have to educate people in terms of what's going on, you know. I mean, you know, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act really deals with the particular pathology of racial discrimination in voting. That's what it's all about. And we need to call it out for what it is. For the People Act, the legislation, you know, it's going to help people of color, which are typically the hardest hit by the burdens that get imposed as a result of voter suppression. And so we need to galvanize the communities. Number one, we need to have massive protests. We need to put people in front of people's offices. And we really need to educate people around the country on this the most serious threat against democracy and against the franchise of voting since the Voting Rights Act was passed.
The other part of this is getting more people registered to vote. Now, you know, Stacey Abrams did a great job, especially in Georgia. Absolutely. What's that old line? Hell hath no fury as a woman scorned, because she should have won that election back in 2018, and that's right. When the current governor, didn't he take a bunch of people off the voting rolls in order to win?
Yeah, they did a serious purge in Georgia, and the commitment by Stacey Abrams. So let me just say this, it was Stacey Abrams who was definitely the leader of that effort. But it was a group, it was a coalition of nine black women who was organized by Stacey Abrams, who worked on this. You know, they worked on this for 3 or 4 years, you know, prior to Stacey, prior before the 2020 election. I mean, it all culminated when she ran for governor, and it intensified, you know, after she was... unfortunately robbed of the election. But, Georgia shows what happens when people are committed.
Right.
Okay, are committed to really using the franchise of voting to make change. But for 8 years prior to Stacey Abrams' election for governor, there was massive voting efforts throughout the state of Georgia. Now, you're talking about a vision for democracy. You know, that's a testament to a clear vision and what can be done when people organize for a specific purpose. You know, we see all kind of egregious laws, everything from, in Georgia, one of the most horrific things I have seen, to outlaw people giving water to folks at the polls. And I'm just talking about doing all kind of stuff that don't even, that is unimaginable in order to prevent people from voting. That these fights and this resistance is going to be state-based, because the suppression laws that's being put in place and passed by state legislators around this country, they vary from state to state.
Right. And in some cases, they can throw out the election. I mean, wow, it's really
gone
too far. Yeah,
it was in Arizona where they, they proposed legislations where the state legislature can really overrule the Board of Elections decision and just throw out an election. I mean, this stuff is crazy. And the unfortunate part about it is it's real. I mean, it's happening in the United States in 2021.
Do you see court challenges? I don't know. I haven't seen anything yet. But when they're turning the screws that far to the right, there's got to be, you know, groups like the ACLU and the Common Cause, you know, progressive groups saying, wait a minute, we're going to take this to court. Is that happening right now in those states?
Yeah. Everything is on the line right now. The ACLU have played a major part in all the states that have tried to purge and change their voting laws. And then you see the Brennan Center have done an enormous amount of work in support of the ACLU lawsuits around the country. And, you know, I mean, you know, progressive groups and organized labor, the environmentalists, and I mean, this is one issue, Flash, that have really pulled folks together. And there's a lot of legal court cases going back and forth to try to resist these efforts. But it all comes down to everybody have organized around the For the People's Act, because this could be repetitive for years to come if we, first of all, don't change the dynamics in terms of allowing states to arbitrarily change the voting law. So this is what the People's Act, which is the John Lewis Voting Rights Bill, come into existence, because what it does is it federalizes, okay, a simple set of rules as it comes to election that applies to all states that can't be modified by the states, okay? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so everybody is putting their effort and challenging the Senate, you know, to pass a piece of election pass a piece of legislation that will give the government, through the Justice Department, oversight to really restore what was in the original Voting Rights Act when we talk about issues of preclearance before any legislation or changes to the voting laws in a state could be passed, but to also make sure that we have a set of rules, okay, such as, you know, eliminating racist gerrymandering. And
right.
There's a set of rules in place that would apply to all, you know, to every state in the country. Now, the Republicans' arguments are, you know, the Constitution says that elections will be held on the state level. And the basis of the 1963 Voting Rights Act was the fact that because they are held on the state level, and these states have a clear history of racism and discrimination when it came to voting, that's just the history. That's the past.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Is that the 63 Voting Rights Act refer those states back to the federal court. And this was the law, you know, up until Shelby versus Holder in 2013. So at the very least, okay, we're hoping that the For the People's Act will restore those provisions to the 63 Voting Rights Act. But
all
we
right.
have to have some control over this. You know, I mean, we got to bring in some adults in this room, okay, to ensure that the voting of people throughout this country, regardless of their race, their sex, or their age, is going to be protected.
Fred, we need a lot of adults in the room. No doubt about that.
Absolutely.
Good conversation. Let's stay on this page. Fred Redmond, who is Vice President of Human Affairs for the United Steelworkers, International Vice President, I might add, usw.org. You take care, and we'll talk down the road. Okay, brother?
Okay, thanks a lot, Flash. Good being with you.
All right, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up Monday, the Transportation Trades Department and the CWA. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful weekend.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.